cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or stream us live on YouTube and Bloomberg.com.
We dealt with the integrated oil companies yesterday because we know that they're going to be reporting earnings. With that in mind, as well as a big development last month, you know, when scientists in California made that key breakthrough in nuclear fusion, we wanted to talk a little bit more about what's going on in this space.
Yeah, we're reaching out again to an organization that blew our minds away when we did our remote broadcast from the New Jersey Institute of Technology last year. Very pleased to have with us Stephen Cowley, Laboratory Director at Princeton Plasma Physics Lab, here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. We've also got a special guest with us joining us this afternoon. Will Wade is Bloomberg Power and Renewable Energy Editor. He's joining us today as well for this conversation. So we're excited to have Will with us as well.
So Stephen, let's start with you. First of all, so great to have you here with us. I know that there's been all of a sudden a lot of attention. Tell us and remind us about the significance of what happened in that California lab and how you guys think about it at your own lab.
Well, the big thing that happened was that they produced an experiment in which the fusion energy that came out of the capsule was more than the energy they had to put in.
Which so they hadn't been able to do before.
First ever, right? And a magnificent achievement. They got 3 megajoules out. 1 megajoule is the power of a hand grenade. Wow. So they got a power of 3 hand grenades coming out of this experiment. That's pretty significant from an object that was about the size of a peppercorn.
So how do you harness this energy and replicate this?
Yeah, piece
scale?
Of cake. Now we can just go off
running. Yeah. Easy now.
It's been done in a lab, but how do you do it to power our homes?
Well, ultimately, fusion is going to be a very sophisticated steam engine because you're using the energy that powers the stars, which is fusion, joining of small nuclei together to make bigger ones, in this case, 2 kinds of hydrogen to make helium. And you're using it to make heat. And then you're using that heat in the very conventional way to power a turbine and make electricity. And that's the goal, right? And yeah, we're now seeing tremendous excitement about taking these kind of scientific results and turning them into something that's commercial. And that's going to be hard.
Do you, Carol, do you have, you know, Christopher Lloyd and Michael J. Fox in your head from like Back to the Future, Mr. Fusion,
this
powering
is real.
The DeLorean?
This isn't a movie,
This is
Tim.
Legit. This is actually happening.
All right, let's bring in Will Wade. As we mentioned, Power Renewable Energy Editor at Bloomberg News. We love talking with Will. So Will, come on in. You have been reporting on this space. Join our conversation. And you've talked with Stephen before.
I have.
And what is it that, you know, you think about in covering this space and what you want to know when you pick the brain of somebody like Stephen?
Well, I guess the key question is how long is it going to take? And the answer always seems to be quite a long time still. We're many, many years out, decades probably. But we should not discount the achievement that they had in California last month. That really was amazing.
All right, so why is it decades, Stephen? Help us through this.
It's decades because at this point we have just lit the fire. We have to make a furnace. And we have to make a furnace that operates 24/7. We have to make a furnace that then, you know, integrates a number of technologies that haven't actually yet been tried. Inside a fusion reactor, you have to make part of your fuel. Mm-hmm. And so you use part of your fusion power to actually make one of the fuels that you then put into your fusion system. Never done that part, right? So there's a lot of work to do.
Right.
I always say to people, I think we know we can do it. The question now is, can we do it at a price you want to pay for your electricity?
Well, can we?
I think we can. I hope in my lifetime, but, you know, I'm getting older.
Is it safe?
Fusion has this nice quantity that's really hard to
you
do.
You said grenade earlier. That got me a little concerned.
Yeah.
You got a problem with that, Tim?
Yeah, a little bit.
It's a bad analogy, isn't it? Yeah.
No, it works.
One of the good things about fusion is that it's very easy to turn off, right? It goes out unless you sustain it.
So it can't, I guess it can't run away. Of like things like, you know, ricocheting off and all of a sudden.
Are you thinking of a meltdown?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
You cannot get a meltdown in a fusion reactor. So the safety prognosis, and we've done analysis of what future fusion reactors might look like, is that fusion reactors could be put next to cities. Fusion reactors could be placed where we now have coal-fired power stations. They could replace in all aspects our current generating capability, and they have these very favorable safety prognoses.
Yeah, the safety about fusion is actually one of the things I think is really cool about it. You mentioned meltdown. That's what we think about when you think of a typical nuclear power plant, which uses fission. So the thing with a fission plant is it's relatively easy to start that type of nuclear reaction. But it's harder to turn it off. That's why they have the cooling pools and all sorts of other things to try and control that. With a fusion reaction, it's much harder to get it going. But if somehow you lost control of it, the thing that's fun about it is that it shuts itself down like super instantly, fractions of a second. So safety is not the biggest concern.
You know, I'm thinking, Will, about where we are as a society and what we've seen over the last year in terms of energy transition. The world is so reliant on fossil fuels. We're going to talk with you about nuclear energy in just a few minutes. But where do governments come in when they're supporting technology like this? Because wouldn't it make sense if everybody just got together and said, hey, we're going all in on fusion?
You got to show me the money.
Yeah.
And on something early like this, it always has to come from government, some kind of subsidized loan or grant programs. Things like this cost a lot of money. And in the early days, it's hard to get, you know, commercial investment in something that's so risky. So you always have to start with government money.
What's been interesting over the last 4 or 5 years is that venture capital has come into the business.
Right.
And in the last year, I think in the last actual calendar year, we had about $2.7 billion of investment into fusion startups. So that's...
So private money.
Yeah, private money generating a set of new ideas and a new energy into the business. And this may propel things forward a lot faster than we're currently going. But there are some fundamental problems to solve. And I always say the most important thing to happen is smart people. We need smart people because this problem is solvable, but it needs some innovation.
Well, I feel like every time we go to NJIT, which is where we talked with a colleague of yours from the lab, like this whole idea of STEM education and how important. My dad was an engineer, worked on the space program, but it was a cool thing for people to be engineers. And I just feel like I don't know if there's that same momentum for people to do that. You talked about having, first of all, the skill set and the people we need to do all this, because there's still a lot to be done to make fusion, I guess, a reality on a grand scale. I mean, do we have the talent out there to do it? Do we have kids getting the right education to make sure we can carry through to the finish line, if you will?
I think young people are very motivated by climate change in a way that my generation probably weren't as strongly. And we're getting huge numbers of applications to grad school, to undergraduates, wanting to work in the space, particularly of fusion energy. I mean, who wouldn't want to work on an energy source that powers the stars, you know?
Right. It feels like kind of the next moonshot, although we took a big step closer, right, in December.
Is the ultimate goal of this, Dr. Cowley, that we have fusion-powered power plants?
Oh, sure. And it's sort of the perfect energy source to marry with renewables. because you could turn it on, you can turn it off, and when the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow, you have a source of energy. It's got this one problem, you know, to actually make fusion happen, you have to recreate the conditions in the middle of a star, and that's very hot, like 200 million degrees, and hold that together while you make the reactions happen. So it's also rather cool.
Well, that's what I think about, like the level like of heat intensity, right? And then having the materials, I'm assuming, right, to make it safe as you do that. So, or is that not such a problem?
So the way, in my laboratory, we deal with that is that we hold the fuel in a cage of magnetic field. And you just hold it suspended so it doesn't touch anything.
Right.
Because if it touched anything, it would just get cold. And, you know, heated up. And we've taken things up to 500 million degrees.
Okay, that sounds pretty hot.
It's hot.
Welcome. Oh, go ahead, Tim.
This is one of the reasons why we wanted Will Wade to continue to join our conversation. He's renewables reporter for Bloomberg News, and he's got a big take out today along with Jonathan Tyrone, all about nuclear power. So we go from fusion to fission. And the idea here, Will, is that we're at a time when the world wants to decrease its reliance on fossil fuels. And here in the U.S., about 50 years ago, and around the world, we built a lot of nuclear power plants. The problem is now these nuclear power plants, they're approaching middle age or beyond.
Middle age or beyond, yeah, they're definitely getting old. The thing is, in the last year and a half or so, I've really seen in the industry a big shift in views on nuclear energy. There used to be a lot of people had sort of just a gut level negative reaction to nuclear, just sort of a fear of the risk.
Well, they lived through Chernobyl.
They did.
Three Mile Island, Fukushima.
All of those are real things. And there's still a lot of people that are just vehemently opposed to the risk from nuclear energy. But a lot of those same people are now starting to realize that the potential risk from nuclear accidents is outweighed by the very real risk of what we're seeing from climate change. And now we're realizing we need that carbon-free nuclear energy to achieve our climate goals.
So, Steve, you understand both fusion and fission, and nuclear power. I mean, is it time for us to continue with some nuclear power because we have to because of the climate, or should we not be? I mean, you understand the space, the radioactive waste that doesn't go away. As we wait for fusion to be a reality on a grand scale, how do you see it?
I think we've got to do fission until we have fusion.
You do.
Because I think the enemy right now is climate change, and it's accelerating. We see all the impact that it's going to have. And the big surprise of the last few years is how renewables have come down in price, and they're doing a terrific job in that sector of the market. But you've always got to back that up with something that's there when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine. And fission can do that. We know how to do the technology. We have to do it more efficiently than we've been doing.
What does that mean, more efficiently?
Well,
building
new nuclear power stations is a very expensive business, and the cost overruns on every project that I've ever seen are phenomenal. It's about managing those projects in a better, more efficient way. And delivering fission at a cost that we really want to pay.
Yeah, part of the problem is that we have not been building nuclear power plants, so we've kind of lost that skill set. We don't have a veteran workforce that knows what they're doing. All the ones that are happening now are kind of one-off projects, which is exactly why they're taking much longer and costing so much more. The only U.S. nuclear power plant under construction is in Georgia. It's Vogtle. It's been under... It's like 7 years behind schedule, and the budget has doubled to $30 billion. But it's supposed to be finished this year.
You talked about a younger generation caring about climate change, so they want jobs in fusion. Younger generation that cares about climate change, if you're saying that fission, nuclear, is also part of the equation, do they want to work at a nuclear power plant, a younger generation? I'm just curious.
I think that's a harder sell. But yeah. I think we should be working on that, frankly, because I think, you know, this is the way to get to net zero. And if you look at any of those plans, like the one we have from Princeton, NZAP, Net Zero America Plan, mm-hmm. right? That plan basically relies on either carbon capture and storage or fission to fill in the gaps.
Is carbon capture, Will, something that is...
I'm skeptical.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I think the technology can work, but can we make it work cost effectively? I think that's the question. I have a lot of questions about carbon capture.
It's literally what it sounds like. It pulls carbon
really
out
is.
Of the environment.
You put something on the smokestack of a coal or gas power plant, you trap the carbon, and then you inject it underground. And
send that carbon back to where it's from. Go ahead, Dr.
I think of those two technologies as being transition technologies. Huh. Neither one do you want to do for decade after decade, because you're going to have to bury the carbon dioxide somewhere.
Right.
And the only and again, with fission, you do have a long-term waste issue, and you don't want to do it for decade after decade.
I was going to say long-term, really long-term.
Yes.
Yeah. So,
which is why you want fusion.
Right.
To replace.
Right.
Deadly for thousands of years.
Well, having visited a nuclear power plant and looked at the pools with the rods, like, it's pretty startling and pretty mm-hmm. like a reality. Renewables, wind, solar, what percentage do you think that they will ultimately be long term? Or is it something that ultimately will...
Well, in a lot of these plans, they're producing 60, 70, 80% of the net. It's just the gaps that become their problem. And, you know, if we have fusion, that might change that environment a lot.
What about battery technology improving faster than fusion?
I think the challenge with battery technology is long duration storage. Batteries are good at short duration, but for instance, in Britain, we have Decembers in which there is no wind. And of course, no sun, because it's Britain. And you have to store up all the energy to power the country for the whole of December. That is enormously challenging with batteries.
Now you live in the Northeast, where, you know, the sun shines 365.
There speaks of California.
Yeah, exactly.
Just got about 30 seconds left here. So what's the next thing when it comes to fusion that we should keep on our radar that you think we might see in the next year?
Well, I expect the NIF results to get better over the year.
Their next test is in February.
Right.
Hopefully they'll replicate what they did or even do better.
They're on the edge of a cliff of what we call gain.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have a gain. They put in 2 megajoules. They got out 3 megajoules. I could see them going up to 10, maybe 15, possibly, over this next year. That would be phenomenal.
Okay, I'm Googling megajoule. What's a megajoule?
A megajoule.
Oh, sorry.
Megajoule, a unit of energy. And
it's a unit of energy.
It's about the energy of a hand grenade or a candy bar.
That's right. That's what you
All
said.
All right. We start with the hand grenade. We end with the hand grenade.
And the candy bar.
Oh, my gosh. Please come back, both of you, because that was just kind of what we were hoping to do and just share that with our audience. Steve Cowley, Dr. Steve Cowley, Laboratory Director at Princeton Plasma Physics Lab. And, of course, our own Will Wade. He is Power and Renewable Energy Editor here at Bloomberg News. Thank you to both of you. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing. The passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec on Bloomberg Radio.
We did want to go back to Microsoft because we got a lot of stocks moving. Microsoft is up about 4.3% following its latest earnings results, profit topping estimates, resiliency of the Azure cloud. We're waiting for that conference call to get a little bit more on the outlook. We've got a perfect voice to talk about that and just the overall tech group.
James Chalkmak is back with us. He's a partner and technology analyst at the asset management firm Clockwise Capital. He joins us via Zoom from Miami, which I think on a, you know, January day like today, a lot of us
not too shabby.
Certainly want to be there. Big smile on your face, James. Good to have you back with us. Microsoft, as Carol mentioned, the second quarter profit topping analyst estimates. It was helped by the strength of its Azure cloud services business, even as demand slumped for PC and corporate software. Shares are about 4% in after hours right now. What are your takeaways?
Yeah, I mean, basically, Microsoft's one that the concerns around the growth in the cloud business have been increasingly priced in over the last couple of weeks. I mean, even Satya Nadella has come out saying that, you know, the slowdown in the cloud could persist longer than some expect. So we think a lot of that was priced into the stock. But the fact that the matter is, even though, you know, there's quote unquote weakness relative to the prior quarters, you know, it's still a resilient and robust rate of growth and upwards of 40%. On a constant currency basis. So I think confidence is coming back there, but most importantly, I think it's the takeaway that the growth curves of these tech companies will normalize around the kind of the pre-COVID rates that a lot of investors had modeled. And I think that confidence coming back into the growth trajectory and the kind of the growth estimates this year and next should help propel these shares higher.
So James, so the stock, speaking of the, you know, propelling shares higher, I mean, it is up more than 4%. And we did know kind of beforehand that Microsoft didn't seem to really participate in the overall more broader tech rally that we've seen since the beginning of the year. So do you feel like it's just kind of a recalibration of not being part of kind of some of the enthusiasm was out there, and then this report saying, okay, maybe it's not so bad, everybody, and that's why the stock is also popping up?
That's actually a great point, because Microsoft is kind of an anomaly in the sense that all of these tech companies, you know, from Amazon, Facebook, Facebook not so much because they had the Apple issues, but, you know, Apple, Amazon, and Google and so forth had a huge demand pulled forward during COVID. 2020, 2021, you saw a rocket surge in the growth rates of these companies. 2022 was a completely different story where the growth rates underperformed. And you had to mathematically see an underperformance relative to the overperformance they saw prior in order to average back into that pre-COVID growth rate. And now that what I think a lot of these stocks got left behind, that people were extrapolating the 2022 results on a go-forward basis. But what we're seeing is a reacceleration of those rates. And I think Netflix is a great case in point of that last week. But with Microsoft, you really didn't have that type of normalization in 2022 to the same extent that you had with the other companies. So it lagging at the beginning of this year versus the broader tech group, I think made sense. So I think that's kind of the explanation for that.
Okay, so let's move from Microsoft to get an idea for, you know, what Microsoft's earnings can tell us about other companies. We saw shares of Amazon rise as soon as these numbers came out, James, as a result of optimism
still
over its cloud
3.2%
business.
Percent
yeah, and shares still higher by more than 3% right now. What can Microsoft tell us about other companies that are set to report over the next couple of weeks?
Number one, cloud spend. Obviously, that's kind of clear as day. You know, what's the implications for cloud, the infrastructure companies, as well as the cloud services that are built on top of it. Two, you know, the health of enterprise spend. And three, the health of the consumer. And I think what we're seeing is more resiliency and possible a green light into a less than expected degree of recession as we progress this year. And warned not to extrapolate, you know, one quarter into a broader trend. But at the end of the day, you know, as the Fed battles inflation and we kind of make assumptions on where rates can go, and as well as the broader, you know, tech layoffs that we're seeing that could trickle into the other parts of the economy, I think it's premature to say that we're out of this. But, you know, if the economy does prove that to be a little bit more resilient than not, you know, these stocks could have a little road ahead of them.
Any names in particular that are on your radar, James, for good or bad reasons?
Sure. I mean, our top three holdings right now are Amazon, Uber, and Meta. You know, we like all those three for different reasons. One, Amazon is completely, you know, pulled back in terms of valuation. We think estimates are fully recalibrated, perhaps not as much for kind of the first quarter guidance. But, you know, as you look into the back half of this year, you should see acceleration. That's trading a sub 2x sales. Uber is a company you're seeing this whole services sector do incredibly well. Uber's a beneficiary of that, also at about 2x sales. And this is going to be a breakout year for them from a profitability standpoint, which as investors increasingly focus on bottom line results. And lastly, on Meta, I mean, this is a stock that's been left for dead. It's at 12, 13 times earnings right now. It's basically almost a deep value name. And you're anniversarying the ATT changes at Apple, which has had a huge adverse impact on their top line last year. So for all those reasons, you know, we think those three are offer the safest risk reward. So, you know, we're most concentrated in those three.
Hey, this is an incredible setup for the earnings season to come, and I can't tell you how much we appreciate it. But I have to say, we're really worried because, James, I don't know if you noticed, but the clouds behind you aren't moving.
Yeah. It's a still.
All right. Looking those, good from Miami, James.
For those watching on YouTube and Quick Take, James Chacmak, so great. Like we said, this is what we hope to do, to just kind of make sense out of what we're seeing in some of these names, because tech is definitely outperforming. NASDAQ 100 this year, up more than 8%. S&P up about 4.6%.
We got Tesla tomorrow.
Yeah, I know. Clockwise Capital. Cool dude.
Yeah, we love James.
We do.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
Keep driving crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, it's time for the Drive to the Close. Just got about 17 minutes left, just under 17 minutes left in today's trading session. Stocks rolling over, and we are seeing a little bit of a leg down here in the final 15, 20 minutes or so. So let's get to it. Let's see what's on the mind of Leo Kelly.
Leo Kelly is founder and CEO at Verdance Capital Advisors. Leo joins us this afternoon on the phone from Hunt Valley, Maryland. Leo, how are you?
I am well. How are you guys?
We're doing pretty well, trying to understand, you know, what's happening with earnings right now, but also what's happening big picture when it comes to the rally that's kind of hit a wall after stocks fluctuated for their best two-day rally since November. What do you make of it, Leo?
I make of it exactly what it is, and that is the market is just fighting between data points that are coming in. The market wants desperately for the Fed to give them a sign of life that they're going to slow down and start to become more accommodative and give them the signal that inflation is behind us, but I just think it's premature for that. Earnings are still going to be representative of the massive inflows of capital that were put in the markets over the last couple of years. And so the market's going to continue to be confused. We have, you know, as you guys know, we haven't been exactly bullish over the last 18 months. Mm-hmm. I still think we have a little more volatility ahead of us, but we're getting there. We're almost out of this thing.
So no bottom yet? I mean, if I look at the NASDAQ 100, what, we're up about 8% so far this year. If I look at the more broader average of the S&P 500, up about 4.5%. So we have seen a little bit of a bounce here. Mind you, we're still way off our highs here on these major equity averages. So more volatility, but are you seeing some signs of a bottoming here on when it comes to stocks, Leo?
We are. So we've been raising capital in the last rally at the end of the year, trying to prepare for a very volatile first quarter. We have to get through earnings, and we're going to have a lot more economic data. And the Fed is going to get its wishes. It is going to slow the economy down. We are going to get some signals that things are slowing, and that will create some concern. That said, bear markets tend to go through a cycle. Everybody wants a bear market to just happen and go away, and that's just not reality. They tend to have three legs, leg one in the summer, which we saw, which is the surprise, leg two, which is the more dramatic, more breath in the bear market that goes down. It's scarier. You get your rally. That third leg tends to be the one that washes out the last hope, and it tends to be more narrow, and then you can start to be constructive. And it looks to us like that volatility is still ahead of us. We still have a little bit more repair to do. Now, on the other side of this, and this is probably the most optimistic you're going to hear me in quite some time. On the other side of this, the Fed is getting close to getting done what it wants. We never believed in transitory inflation. We didn't believe they were ahead of the inflation curve all year last year, but they're finally starting to get ahead of this thing. And so as we start to see inflation come down and the Fed slow down and eventually stop rate increases, then we can get back to productivity in the economy. And there's a lot to get done here between rebuilding the supply chain and what is already a confident consumer coming back.
Okay, so lots of questions I have for you, Leo. What would bring us to that sort of third leg down that we're awaiting?
Sometimes it's just the market tires. You get past earnings. You don't have any other news to trade. And then the Fed is still doing what it's doing. Interest rates go up. And again, what tends to happen with the third leg of the market is not everything goes down back to its prior lows. That tends to be very narrow. So I don't know if we'll make a new low, but my guess is we'll still have some more downside that I would, if I was an investor, I would use to accumulate assets. The bond market's going to be better this year than it was last year because we have yield coverage. Rates are higher. We're not coming from essentially zero. So as the bond market damage starts to slow down and the Fed slows down, that's when I think we go. I think the other point, too, remember in a bear market, is stocks get cheaper. Right? 18 months ago, when we were talking about growth looking like 2000, stocks are very expensive. Well, a lot of damage has been done. Now, again, I don't think technology is the future leadership, but a lot of tech has gotten cheap enough that it's buyable.
Microsoft, earnings after the close. Just got about a minute left here. Might this help sentiment in some way, one way or the other, or hurt it?
No, I don't think any specific earnings report by Microsoft or anyone else. I think there's a much bigger picture that investors need to look at. And that is where interest rates are going. And when the Fed does slow down and starts to pull back, will inflation come roaring back again? I think those are bigger issues. And then the return of the economy, the infrastructure spend that's coming, the consumer coming back. I think those are the bigger picture issues.
Just in the last 30 seconds we have, do you think inflation could come roaring back? We're seeing it move in the right direction.
Yes, I absolutely think it can come roaring back if the Fed pulls back too quickly. We cannot understate that we saw the greatest economic anomaly in the history of man, shutting down a $20 trillion economy and flooding the system with trillions of capital. That's still in the system. And so, yes, if the Fed pulls back too early, we could see inflation come roaring back. It is the risk that's why they're being very specific with their language.
Right.
And they're telling us we're not done.
Yeah, we did have a U.S. business activity indicator, some economic news earlier today, contracting for a seventh month, was at a more moderate pace, but a measure of input prices firmed and a sign of lingering inflationary pressure. So we are far from out of the woods, even though it feels better and we're off the peak, but nonetheless, something to keep on our radar. That's a wrap. Leo, thank you. Leo Kelly, founder and chief executive officer at Verdant Capital Advisors, joining us on the phone from Hunt Valley.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or stream us live on YouTube and Bloomberg.com.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.